From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
The looming budget is seen by the government, the opposition and voters as squarely directed to the election that's due in the first half of next year. It will contain income tax cuts and no doubt other carrots as well. In the budget debate and at the election, tax will be a central issue. The government is painting Labor as the big taxing party. Labor is denouncing the government for persisting with trying to get its company tax cuts for big business through the Senate. Budget week will also see opposition leader Bill Shorten give a reply that will be closely watched for its announcements and its directions. Ahead of the budget, we're joined by Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen. Chris Bowen, before we get to the budget, Labor MP Tim Hammond from Western Australia has quit because of the pressures on his young family. How tough have you found combining the demands of politics and family life?
Well, look, I think every Member of Parliament has had a time and an occasion to reflect on the impact of our jobs on our family, and it can be tough. And nobody's just seeking any sympathy, nobody's seeking any understanding, but it's just a statement of fact that you're away. In most cases, by the time you get to the end of the year, look back on your calendar and your diary, you've been away 8 months out of the 12 months of the year, sleeping in a hotel room somewhere else. And that has an impact. And particularly the Western Australian members and the Northern Territory members, those who come from a long distance, North Queensland, what have you, they do it particularly tough. I live 3 hours drive from Canberra, so it's a little bit different to the plane ride back and forth every week. Tim's a terrific fellow. I know he didn't take this decision lightly, but he's put his family first. And he's at pains to say that that doesn't mean that you can't be a Member of Parliament, particularly from the West, and have a young family, but it means he can't. He just found it impossible. And as gutted as I am by that decision, because he is a very valuable contributor, I also understand his decision.
Yes, I think people on both sides are wishing him well.
Absolutely.
Now, turning to the budget and the election, how is Labor going to counter what could be quite a potent argument, and that is that it will be the bigger taxer?
Well, of course, at the end of the day, our plans will be there to be compared with the government's. Now, the government has just very recently, in the last week, dropped their income tax rise. They were saying we were the bigger taxer at the same time as they were proposing an income tax rise on Australians earning between $21,000 a year and $87,000. Now, I am very happy to have a debate about our competing tax plans, including the government's corporate tax cut, and importantly, the budget plans. You know, the government seems to be saying budget repair doesn't matter anymore, budget surplus doesn't matter, the Treasurer won't commit to 1% of GDP surplus, which used to be in the government's budget rules. So let's have all our plans compared. Yes, we have a different set of priorities. Yes, and we make no apologies for saying there are certain elements of the tax system which are unaffordable and unsustainable, like negative gearing, like dividend imputation refundability, which is, of course, not a tax rise, but is simply making the system fairer. These are all things which I'm very happy to have debated, and I very much welcome a debate now or an election campaign.
Now, I know you won't give precision, but can we expect to see Labor's counter package on income tax sooner or later? That is, nearer the budget or nearer the election?
Well, certainly we won't be leaving it to the last minute. We're laying out all our policies. We've laid a lot. I think Michelle is one of Australia's, if you don't mind me saying, most experienced and respected political journalists. You've covered more election campaigns than pretty much anybody. I think you would agree that we've laid out more policy than most oppositions at this point of the electoral cycle. Most oppositions wait until much, much closer to election day. We're not doing that. We're laying out our plans very early, and we'll continue to do so. Now, I'm not going to get into sort of when exactly. We'll announce particular policies of any variation, but we'll certainly be laying out our plans with plenty of time for Australian people to judge them.
One tax issue where timing is important, one would have thought, for many businesses, is your decision on what part of the already legislated company tax cuts you'll accept in government, if you reach government. When can we expect that decision?
Well, again, we've indicated that we want to see the budget, and we'll have more to say about what's already been legislated. We're vehemently opposed to the government's attempt to extend the corporate tax cut to what is now an $80 billion cost over the decade with another financial year coming in. And we've just said we accept and respect that what has already been legislated does need to be considered by us, and it would be prudent for us to take our time to do that. Again, we'll be laying it out in plenty of time before the next election, but I'm not announcing a particular timetable.
The Greens have just released a tax policy that says we should have a Buffett rule, that is, a rule that says that the wealthiest taxpayers should be forced to pay a minimum rate of tax. You oppose such a rule. Why is that?
Well, it's a very blunt instrument. Now, the Greens have had this policy for a long time. There's nothing new there. Now, a couple of things, Michelle. Firstly, they call it a Buffett rule or a Buffett tax. There is no, you know, I prefer to call it the Buffett concept. There is no country in the world that has done this. And there's no major party of government or opposition, the only alternative government around the world, which currently has this as policy either.
Obama did propose it, did he not?
Well, he talked about the issue and the concept. Now, what we are doing is closing the other loopholes, which primarily benefit those who are of high wealth or high income. But if you just have a blanket rule, a very blunt instrument, well, what you're then doing is saying, we don't care how much money you donate to charity, we don't care how many philanthropic activities you support or how much venture capital and angel investing you engage in, we're not providing you with the appropriate tax deductions. Now, what we are saying is, well, we are identifying one by one tax concessions which benefit high-income earners, which aren't fit for purpose, aren't sustainable, and we're reforming those or closing them down, as the case may be, as is appropriate. Just simply engaging in the Buffett rule, which no country in the world has done, is a nice concept, but it's not actually sound policy.
Fairness and inequality are Labor's themes, but how much do political considerations, in fact, inhibit the full pursuit of these?
Well, I mean, I don't think anybody could accuse us of going soft on matters which improve the progressivity of the tax system. I mean, people said that any government or any opposition which embraces negative gearing reform is going to lose the next election. People said the same about family trusts. Now, we've got all those policies out there, and they're all working in terms of being debated and being looked at, and we're very happy with where we're at in the political debate about those. These are all highly progressive measures, and again, ones which people said before were too controversial. So you've always got to think about how you're going to explain your policies, who's going to be impacted by them, who's going to lose, how you're going to explain it to them. Of course you do. That's our job as politicians, but it doesn't mean that you can, or we certainly haven't, shy away from difficult reforms.
Bill Shorten said that welfare payments need review. Can those on unemployment benefits, which in particular are very low, look forward to a better deal if Labor's elected?
Well, look, this is a matter of some public debate at the moment. There's been people commenting about this. Clearly, the start allowance is one of the, if you like, for lack of a better word, least generous in our system. We've said things about that in the past. We'll continue to look at these matters. We'll announce our policies as and when we're ready. But our focus has been on creating budget repair, which is fair. We want to get back to budget surplus. That's an important reform. It's important for all sorts of reasons. And, of course, we also make important investments in things like health and education.
On this question of budget repair, even though you're saying it's important, both sides seem willing to leave it for a few years. Shouldn't it actually be given a higher priority, especially when there seems to be a lot of revenue now floating about?
Well, I think that getting back to budget balance is very, very important, and not just budget balance, but a good, healthy budget surplus of at least 1% of GDP. This is what's important. A surplus of 0.5% of GDP is very subject to the vagaries of the international economy. Now, what we've got to do is ensure that we have a surplus which is healthy and sustainable, and which is not one which can be blown away in a small breeze. And at the moment, we've got to ensure that we are getting back not just a budget surplus by a particular year and then forgetting about it, setting and forgetting, but that our surpluses are healthy and sustainable.
So will you try to be really competitive or beat the government on this ground of fiscal responsibility? Last time, in fact, your bottom line looked a bit worse than theirs at the last election. Are you going to try to change that this time?
Well, again, we're going to outline all our fiscal rules and plans, but at the last election, there was a gap. A lot of that was what we call zombie measures, so measures which the government had on their books but we knew would never pass. Of the $16 billion, about $13 billion was zombie measures. Now, we've been vindicated by that. Those measures haven't passed, and many of them have since been dropped by the government, and speculation more will be dropped next week. Certainly, I am very confident that the budget numbers we present to the Australian people will provide them with reassurance that our fiscal plans are sustainable and healthy.
Let's just look at a couple of measures. You mentioned negative gearing. Is it harder to persuade people about this proposed crackdown now that some of the steam's gone out of the housing market?
Well, I think anybody who thinks that everything's sorted, that the housing market's now under control and young people can get into the market very easily, are kidding themselves. There's a long way to go, and certainly young people, particularly those who struggle to get in the housing market primarily, certainly recognise that. Scott Morrison might think it's all over, but we don't. But also, it's important that your tax settings are sustainable, not just any one particular time, but for the long term. That's what's important, that we make sure that our settings are right, not just for today, not just for tomorrow, but for all times. Now, our negative gearing reform is about housing affordability. It's also about making the tax system fairer, about improving the budget, all of those things.
On your plan to scrap cash refunds from franked dividends, you exempted pensioners, but how much blowback are you still getting? In other words, do you still have a lot of work to do to sell this to the community?
Well, I think all our policies, Michelle, require constant vigilance and constant communication. Now, here we have the situation where we're the only country in the world with fully refundable dividend imputation. It's an anomaly in our tax system. Most tax concessions are not refundable, i.e. you can get your taxable income down to zero, but if you haven't paid income tax, the tax office, other taxpayers, will not provide you with a further cheque, a cash refund for tax you haven't paid. Now, of course, those who are worse off out of this, people who are losing their cash refunds, many of them are annoyed. Some of them might not vote for us, but it's the right thing to do. This costs $6 billion a year, will rise to $8 billion a year, and it overwhelmingly benefits people of high wealth. Now, of course, some people, again, won't like it, but we are being very upfront with our plans. This is necessary for budget repair. Dividend imputation is important. It's an important part of our tax system. You shouldn't be taxed twice. And what John Howard did by introducing refundability is not do with double taxation, but do with single taxation. If a company pays tax and the shareholder is somebody who doesn't pay income tax and the tax that the company has paid is refunded to that shareholder, there has been no tax collected, no net tax collected. Now, if we talk about corporate tax evasion, here we've got an example where, in effect, no tax is being paid on that corporate profits. It's not fair, it's not sustainable, and it's got to be dealt with. We're being honest and upfront and saying we'll deal with it.
Now, let's turn to the bad behaviour by the financial institutions, the banks, AMP. People have been deeply shocked by what's come out at the Royal Commission. Do you think there needs to be a stronger regime of rules or simply stronger enforcement?
Well, let's see what the Royal Commission recommends. Thank goodness we've got the Royal Commission. That was something that the government has wanted to avoid for years. Thank goodness that we prevailed and the Royal Commission is being held. Otherwise, many of these scandals would not be being brought before the public. This is an example of Labor getting the big calls right and the government getting them wrong. Now, the Royal Commission having been established, we want it to do its work. And I'm not going to preempt what the Royal Commission will recommend. I imagine he'll recommend some element of both of those things that you've just, you know, forecast to me. Now, but I don't really want to get into that because we don't know. You don't know what the Royal Commission will recommend. I don't know. Indeed, the Royal Commissioner probably doesn't know yet because he's still doing his work. We should let him get on with that. And when he's made his report, I would hope that governments of either persuasion would look at his recommendations very, very seriously, and the default position would be to implement them.
Well, we don't need the Royal Commission report to think about whether more corporate heads should roll because we've seen the evidence. Do you think they should? And what about, for example, Catherine Livingstone?
Well, in relation to the Commonwealth Bank, I mean, that was a very serious report that we saw yesterday. It certainly is very scathing of the Commonwealth Bank, and as I've said publicly. Now, the Treasurer was out there saying, well, more heads will roll, implying that he knew something. Well, he clearly doesn't know, because the only future changes that I'm aware of in the Commonwealth Bank's management structure will be those two board directors who are coming to the end of their natural term, been on the board for a long time. In relation to Catherine Livingstone, a politician should not call for the resignation of a chair beyond the most exceptional circumstances. I think Catherine Brenner was exceptional circumstances. Now, Catherine Livingstone's been the chair of the Commonwealth Bank
since very early in 2017. That's not that long ago. She hasn't been on the board for a long period of time, and she's a pretty respected business person. So I'm not going to call for a resignation. I don't think that should be done lightly, and I don't think the Treasurer should engage in that speculation unless he seriously has reached the view that individuals should be removed, and if he has, he should say so, and who those individuals are and why.
Now, Labor is at odds with big business over tax cuts, and business has given notice that it will be campaigning in the run-up to the election. I just wonder how you're managing your relations, indeed your party's relations, with the corporate sector, and why wouldn't they be trying to ward off a Labor government given your policy on company tax cuts?
Well, not every business thinks that the corporate tax cut is the main game, the big deal for them. Now, of course, some people in the business community do. That is their right. We believe in a different set of priorities. Now, I completely understand and accept that big business will lobby on their own behalf. That doesn't mean that we have to agree with them. There should be an attitude of mutual respect, but that does not mean mutual agreement or automatic agreement. And clearly we have a difference of view with the Business Council, not with every member of the Business Council. Some members of the Business Council say to me that they don't see the business tax cut as a priority. The Business Council's chosen to prioritise that. That's their right under our democratic system. We have a different view.
When you visit boardrooms, do you find them a bit frosty or
no,
a bit standoff?
Generally not, no. I find that people want to hear about our plans, and if they disagree, that discussion is held in an atmosphere of understanding and respect.
Earlier on, you were stressing that Labor's policies were well-based, they weren't politically just based on populism. But I think you'll agree that these days it's much harder to get evidence-based policy. There are more pressures on governments and oppositions in the permanent campaign to appeal to people directly and immediately. Do you think this is a problem in getting economic reform?
Look, I think that that has always been thus, I think. You know, politicians arguing for economic reform have always had their work cut out. I don't think it is now particularly much harder than in the past, I think.
I should say at this point that you've written a book about treasurers.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I have studied the economic and political debates of the last 130 so years, and what we do find is that it's never been easy. The treasurers in particular are arguing for economic reform have never had an easy road to hoe. I don't think it's particularly harder for me or any other people now. It's different. 24-hour media cycle, many more media outlets, social media, all that's true. It's different, but it's not harder. In fact, there are now opportunities. I'm talking to you, Michelle. You've got a podcast. You didn't have a podcast 10 years ago. This is an opportunity for your listeners to hear from me and other people with economic ideas and weigh them up and consider them. That's not an opportunity that we've previously had. And those of us who are in the game of arguing for reform should be using those opportunities, not washing our hands and saying, oh, it's all too hard, we might get smashed on social media. Get out there and argue your case. That's what I do, it's what we do, and it can be done.
Just finally, you were briefly Treasurer in the Labor government. What was the biggest lesson you learned, and what might you do differently if you're in that job after the election next year?
Michelle, it was all too brief. All too brief. I was only there for a relatively short period of time. I'm one of the shortest serving treasurers in our history, a situation I hope to remedy at the next election.
I'm sure you learned some things, though. What were they?
Yeah, look, it was an intense period. I think, Michelle, I wouldn't put it so much in terms of what I learned in that few months I was treasurer. I did learn things. I interacted with the Treasury very carefully and closely. Some of that experience I'll draw on. I've also spent the last 5 years as shadow treasurer thinking about the role, preparing myself, wrote the book on the history of treasurers, looked at the role of finance ministers and treasurers around the world, immersed myself in current economic debate as much as possible, globally as well as domestically. I do feel prepared to be treasurer. I've spent a lot of time thinking about the role, preparing for it. It's not just what I learned in my few months as treasurer, it's what I learned in my 5 years or so as a cabinet member, assistant treasurer, minister for financial services, sitting around the expenditure review committee table. And in my time as shadow treasurer, when maybe I'm still very busy, of course, but it's not the same demands on your time as when you're treasurer or a cabinet member. So you can do some reflecting and some thinking and some writing. I've been doing that, by and large, to prepare myself for being treasurer. I went took myself off and got myself a university degree in Indonesian language, because they'll be the world's fourth largest economy over the next couple of decades, and we're not interacting with them enough economically as well as in other areas. It's a very important bilateral relationship for us, and I think more young people need to be learning Asian languages, and we can't lecture them about that if we're not prepared to do it ourselves. So these are all things which I've spent time thinking about and preparing for the role of Treasurer. I feel prepared. Some of which I learnt while I was Treasurer, and other things I've concentrated on developing since I've been Shadow Treasurer.
Chris Bowen, thank you for talking with us today. That's all from our conversation podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Berlage. We'll be back to you with another interview soon. Goodbye for now.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.